Trainer Talks and Tales acknowledges the traditional owners and custodians of the land in which we're recording this podcast, the Turrbal and Yugara people of Meanjin. We pay our respects to elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Trainer Talks and Tales love having an array of guests with a variety of opinions. However, the views of the individuals do not necessarily reflect the perspectives of the host facilities.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talks and Tales. My name is Tess. You might not have heard this voice for a while, but I'm back in your ears and I'm joined by the lovely Daisy. Hey, Daisy, what's happening with you?
Hello. Yes, so good to have you back on more regularly. We are recording this intro a little bit far in advance just because I am heading to Canberra on Saturday. No zoo trips for me this time. I'm heading to the ski, to the snow, to do some skiing. Wow. On the snow. On the snow. Christ, I don't even have a baby brain. It is 8:30 at night though, which is really late for me.
I'm heading to the ski.
Anyway, I hope you got the picture by that. But it is my birthday, so I'm going away to ski and drink some wine. So that's why we're doing the intro early.
Nice. Yeah, we got there.
Yeah. Anyway, what are you doing this week, Tess? Any plans?
No, not really. My life is a bit of Groundhog Day, but it's a good one. Actually, no, that's a lie. I'm going camping this weekend. Look at me. Exciting.
So that's
going
fun.
Camping, yeah, with my family and a newborn. So not as soundproof as a house. So good luck to anyone camping in Wuyong this weekend, because that canvas is not very soundproof. But yeah, that's exciting with me.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
Yeah, it'll be good. But let's get into this episode. It's a bit of an interesting one. We actually are joined by my husband, Chris.
Yay.
So we're going to chat about his role in fisheries. So he's been doing a lot of cool stuff over the last few years. He started in the zoo industry and then is now working in a government role. So this is a good episode if you are perhaps interested in learning a little bit more about government roles and what they can entail. And yeah, let's get into it.
Absolutely. Let's do it. Chris, thank you so much for joining Tess and I on Trainer Talks and Tales this week. You are, of course, Tess's fabulous husband, but way more importantly, you are our incredible producer and basically the man behind the screen that no one else gets to see, but you do so much work and we are so grateful to have you on and for everything you do. So welcome to the podcast, Chris.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here. I feel a little underqualified to be on Trainer Talks and Tales. Maybe in the background is where I should stay, but hopefully it's exciting enough to keep your listeners listening.
No, definitely not. We're so excited to have you on, and I just think it's worth telling the listeners that Tess and Chris are at home together, but in separate rooms so they can keep it together and not giggle all the way through.
This is very weird for me because I can hear him in the other room like 5 seconds later. So very confusing. That's all right.
Well, Chris, you know better than anyone, because you edit our beautiful podcast, that we start our episodes with a fast five. So we are going to throw that straight at you to start with. Does that sound good?
Yep, sounds good. I'm nervous.
Okay, question number one. Hard or soft cookies?
Soft.
Beach or forest?
Beach.
Rock melon or watermelon?
Oh, rock melon.
Sunrise or sunset?
Oh, I probably should say sunrise, but I'm never there for it. Sunset.
And finally, sharks or dolphins?
Ooh, sharks, I think.
Nice. I feel like you might
that be is stressful.
Semi-psycho to answer that you like hard cookies over soft cookies. Like, I don't know who would
choose
that.
That's wild. Yeah, I didn't know if that was a trick question or not.
Well, like I said, we're both super excited to chat to you today. You have a really exciting career that we're keen to talk through, and we've got some really cool questions to chat about. You obviously started in the zoo industry back when you were quite young. You're only 19 and worked in and around zoos for about 8 years or so before moving into a more permanent government role. Could you maybe chat a little bit about what your sort of career looked like early on and how you got to where you are now?
Yeah, sure. I left school and started working at a dive shop as my first job, and I loved it. And it was like predominantly retail and boring stuff, but on the weekends we could go out and take little groups out diving and stuff. And I sort of chipped away at some qualifications there. And I worked over in Papua New Guinea for a while, and I had to kind of, it was only 2.5, 3 months, I think. And I had to drop everything to do it, working with a guy from James Cook Uni, scuba diving 3 or 4 times a day, every single day, and got back from that. And I'd sort of, yeah, like I said, I had to sort of let go of all of the work that I had and commit to that. And I got back and I had nothing on. And by, yeah, just sort of stumbled across, I'd always known about Lone Pine, and just kind of stumbled across the website, and there was like an apply here page, and there was no advertisements or anything. And I just put the resume off thinking like, this could be something fun to tie me over until the next adventure or until I work out what I want to do. And I got a call back the same day from the curator who introduced me to this job I'd never even heard of, which was cutting food for koalas. And that little in-between job ended up being like 7 or 8 years of working at Lone Pine and absolutely loving it. And it kind of changed the course of my career for that time away from what my real lifetime passion was, which was the marine stuff. And yeah, I got this amazing opportunity to kind of delve into the zoo world and get into that. And then after that, I think 7.5, 8 years. It was a good solid amount of time. And that was starting off leaf cutting and then doing bits and bobs of like koala related stuff. And then I did predominantly Australian native mammals, so dingoes, devils, wombats, platypus, all the legends. And yeah, it was kind of ended up being a bit of a jack of all trades, I guess, at the zoo, doing a little bit of maintenance stuff as well and doing whatever I could really just to stay busy. And then eventually I sort of got to a point, I think it was about 3 years into the zoo, there was, you know, and this is probably something to highlight, because the zoo industry, as we all know, you are sort of hamstrung by opportunities that become available. And at the time, all of the positions were stitched up, and it's a great facility, and lots of people wanted to stay in those positions. So it hit about 2.5 years, I think, and I was not feeling like I was able to get into any of those places that I wanted to go. So I made the call to jump back into uni. I had tried 6 months straight out of school, hated it. And anyway, sort of thought, well, nothing's happening for me here. I should keep chipping away at that degree. And so I started doing that part-time in the background and kept doing it part-time all the way through to the end of my Lone Pine time, where I ended up, yeah, getting through it, getting a bachelor's degree in that time, sort of very slowly. I think it's a 3-year degree and it took me like 7 years or something. A lot of holidays and breaks. And then I was really fortunate to get a call from one of our good friends, Sarah, who was working at RSPCA in the animal rescue team at the time. That was a great opportunity. I didn't work there for ages. It was under a year, just under a year, but really fun job. Like, it was all animal rescue. 95% was Australian wildlife, lots of macropods, lots of fun raptors as well, which Tessa love, wedge-tailed eagles and all sorts of falcons and goshawks and things that used to get stuck in big warehouses, and working shifts all over the place, all over Southeast Queensland. And it was in that job that I kind of got my first little taste of working with legislation and compliance and that kind of thing. We had limited powers. So if people had animals that were in, you know, pets that were in distress, we had powers to enter property without permission and provide relief, and powers to seize animals that were in a really bad state and that kind of thing. And that kind of something about that legislation world sort of clicked with my brain, and I really enjoyed it. An opportunity came up shortly after that to work with Brisbane Council doing environmental compliance stuff. Probably one of the most boring jobs I think I could have ever had. It was looking at development sites and looking at like whether or not they were complying with the rules for development sites. But that gave me, I guess, the foundation that ultimately got me into Queensland Fisheries, which is where I am now, which has been really my dream job that I didn't know was my dream job until I started.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's incredible to hear sort of about your progress and how it's kind of really organically happened for you. Going back slightly to your time at Lone Pine, what was your favorite part of that time at Lone Pine?
Yeah, Chris.
Yeah.
it kind of was like you could broadly like slice it up into I guess, eras. So that initial time, like I was 19, I was leaf cutting, and I used to just give We'd start at 5 in the morning. So I did, I did see a few sunrises in that time, whether I was mentally there for them or not. But so we'd start at 5 in the morning, me and another, you know, there was these bunch of guys, two of the guys ended up being my groomsmen at my wedding. So they turned into, you know, my best mates. And we used to jump in a car first thing in the morning, head out as far as we could go and look for the best koala food that we could get. So we were four-wheel driving. We all got really excited about koala food. We all learnt a lot about eucalypts and we got really into it. And that was a really fun time. You know, we went as far as Bundaberg North, Goondiwindi South, saw a lot of Southeast Queensland and got a lot of crazy stories and fun times out of it. And then I guess the second block was more of a keeping role, was the mammals and that kind of thing, and different, but also really, really loved it. We sort of did some really preliminary training sort of stuff there, which is why I feel very underqualified to be on Trainer Talks and Tales. I don't feel like, you know, we were doing some early day stuff, which I know that team has continued to do and continued to build, but yeah, still a lot of fun.
I think Daisy was actually leading you to say what was the best part of Lone Pine. And that's when you say meeting Tess, but that's okay. You look straight into other stuff. But
you even gave me a prompt as well.
Yeah,
meeting Tess was the real defining moment.
That's all right. We'll just gloss over that. You did some cool stuff.
just having your baby, no worries.
Yeah, no, I did. I met my wife there, and that was incredible.
Anywho, now obviously you're in fisheries, and a lot of people actually ask me, what is fisheries? What does Chris do? So can you tell us a little bit more about what exactly is fisheries?
Yes, fisheries is a really big organisation. Obviously, it's within Queensland government. I guess to put it as simply as I can, their job is to ensure that we have a sustainable seafood industry. So they keep that balance between being able to sustainably harvest our seafood resources and make sure that they are sustainable so they can continue to be used and enjoyed for forever. Yeah, anything that affects that productivity and sustainability falls into, I guess, our portfolio as fisheries. It's a very broad range of jobs, from research all the way through to development that relates to fisheries resources, through to, you know, on the ground stuff, actually being out on the boats and the trawlers and monitoring that activity. So it's, yeah, there's a lot of different elements to it.
Over your time working in that role and working, I guess, amongst the fisheries, obviously for me, it's something that we kind of touch on every single day with working with marine animals, is how that their wild populations are massively impacted by the lack of food availability and overfishing, and trying to educate guests about choosing sustainably sourced seafood. Have you seen changes over the time that you've been within the industry for the fisheries, with sort of the impact that's happening on our native wildlife?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going through a time now that's just, we're changing all the time, and they're taking on new science and making new management decisions probably at a record rate. Yeah, there's changes to entire fisheries, the way that we fish, where we can fish, how much we can fish, what times of the year we can fish. And Queensland is, you know, we're blessed. We've got this huge variety of different fisheries that we work with, you know, from beach to mare to prawn fisheries to, you know, line caught reef fisheries to, you know, nets, net fisheries, all these different really, really broad things. But we've also got this massive responsibility in having things like the Great Barrier Reef and some really unique environments in our coastal area as well. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm proud to work there. I think that I see always a progression towards better sustainability from the department, and it's really empowering and exciting to see.
Yeah, I think it's actually really nice to hear that from you, because I think sometimes it's easy to just like relay a message and tell people to do this, and then we don't really know exactly how much impact that's happening or if our government authorities are doing anything about it at all. So it's actually really, really reassuring to know that it is so present on your minds, and it's a really dominant thing that's happening within your role at the moment to hopefully improve what we're doing, and therefore, you know, improve the animals that are living out in the wild and their fish availability.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's difficult too, because Queenslanders love seafood. We love to eat you know, fresh wild caught prawns. We love a good piece of fish that's fresh caught locally and all that sort of stuff. So it's, yeah, it's nice to know, you know, when you watch documentaries like, what was that recent one? Oh, there's a recent fishing documentary anyway, where they...
The Seaspiracy, sort of, was it that one?
Or? Seaspiracy, that's the one, maybe. Yeah. And they paint a very bleak picture, and I don't doubt that that is the picture in a lot of other countries and a lot of other places, but Australia and Queensland, I think, are really setting the bar in a lot of ways in their management. Obviously, there's always space to improve, but we're doing as well as we could be, I think, at the moment.
And just on that, what is your specific role?
Yes, well, I have become aware since finding out I was doing this podcast that my wife doesn't actually have much of a clue about what I do in my day-to-day.
Mm-hmm. No, Daisy messaged and said, oh, yeah, I'd love to know a bit more about Chris's role. And I was like, yeah, me too, bro. I don't
Not sure.
Ripper. I'm a secret agent. And no, I started in the Queensland Boating and Fisheries Patrol. And it's a kind of specialist part of fisheries that deals with the compliance. And it's a really broad, they're kind of pretty old part of the department. So we've been looking after quite a few different pieces of legislation and making sure that people are complying with them. So we do obviously the Fisheries Act stuff. We also do some boating safety stuff, you know, all the fun stuff. We do a little bit of federally managed boating safety as well for like offshore trawlers and commercial vessels, but not too much of that. Marine Parks, Biosecurity Act, Great Barrier Reef Marine Park, Nature Conservation Act. There's a few more to throw in there as well. So it's a really broad, there's a lot of different bits of legislation we need to know. We're out there in the field, I guess, making sure that people are playing by the rules. The bulk of the work is related to fisheries stuff. So you could be out on the boat talking to a recreational fisher who's just out for the day trying to catch a feed. You could be talking to a commercial trawl operator, you know, miles offshore. Could be talking to net fishermen, all sorts of things. It's a really diverse job, and sort of been doing that for about 4 years, and more recently have specialised in a job where I'm still doing similar stuff, but it now relates to any development that impacts on fisheries, where people are illegally clearing mangroves and that kind of thing, any marine habitat of concern for us. So that's like going out there, collecting evidence, taking people to court. So I have to do that side of things every now and then as well, stand up in court and prepare a lot of documents for lawyers and that kind of thing. So it's a really diverse job. It's definitely a continual learning curve for me.
Yeah, no, it sounds incredible. And it sounds like you cover such a variety of different things within your role. I saw actually, I think earlier on in the year that they mentioned at Stradbroke Island that they've now finished up any working trawlers that used to trawl off Straddy, just to leave the kind of the marine life and the marine environments around Stradbroke Island completely bare of that. Would that have been something the fisheries would have had control over?
Bits and pieces. We work really closely with marine parks. So, you know, if you're talking about green zones, marine parks look after that, but it's obviously all in consultation with fisheries to make sure that they're not going to put a halt on the industry. But we have our own closed areas as well. So like out off Straddy, we've got Flat Rock, which is no fishing because there's a grey nurse shark population that comes in winter. So they've made that a no fishing zone under fisheries legislation. So yeah, there's lots of different mechanisms, I guess, to manage our commercial fishing and recreational fishing. And we all sort of have to work together to make sure we're not doubling up and make sure we're not missing out either.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's really interesting. Now, obviously, like working for a government role, I can imagine that's a fairly desirable job for a lot of people who might be at the moment working within zoos or aquariums facilities around the country. I can imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe the criteria or the process of applying for those jobs is a little bit more intense than applying for maybe a zoo job that's not government run. Do you think you could possibly share like any tips or tricks that you might have for applying for those roles, setting people up to succeed?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that I've seen now, having gone through that process on the other side of the panel, is there's a very specific way that you need to apply for jobs. In Queensland, it's called the STAR method, situation, task, action, response. So it's these kind of things that you need to tell a story in that framework. And from what I've seen from around Australia, at least, it's really similar for all other departments, other state agencies. But all government jobs come with instructions on how to apply. And it's really obvious when people skip them, and it's really obvious when people read them. Because that process needs to be fair, equitable, without bias, they need to be able to read these applications and assess them against a criteria, against a benchmark. It can't just be like, I get a good vibe with this one. You've got to tick boxes. You've got to make sure you're addressing the criteria that they're looking for. And so I would say for applying, yeah, really important that you take the time on your cover letter. Your resume obviously needs to back it up with the right qualifications and all that sort of stuff. But I would say that take the time to go through your cover letter, make sure you're addressing the points that they're looking for and in the way that they're asking you to do it.
So you're basically saying you didn't click a box saying apply now and get a call back that day? Is that...
No, absolutely not. And actually, there was a time at Lone Pine where I decided that I wanted to be a park ranger. I was like, I want to change, like be a ranger. And I reckon I did 10 applications in 3 months and didn't get a call back for any of them. And the reason was because I wasn't addressing criteria and I wasn't putting it forward in the format. Like for a lot of people, a cover letter is an opportunity to try and put yourself forward as this, like, I'm a nice guy, I'm a great, or, you know, I'm a good person, you're going to like me. But for at least for Queensland government, the cover letter is a really important part of that application that shows the assessor that you are capable of addressing those key criteria, they call them.
Makes sense. Now, obviously you studied marine biology and ecology. Was this imperative for your role as a fisheries officer?
Not initially. So when I first started with Queensland Birding and Fisheries Patrol, it's not. And we have a really, really broad range of people that have come in, some from commercial fishing backgrounds, some from trades, some from ranger positions, some from compliance, which is, I think, where I really sort of probably got the shoe in there. So no, not for that. But the role that I've moved into now, it was a requirement for me to have a degree for that was relevant.
Yeah, okay. And on that, I guess, like, what are some maybe areas or disciplines in government that you might find fit the skill set that a zookeeper might already have?
Yeah, it's really broad. And it's something that I probably didn't realise, particularly that first sort of run of applications that I put in, where I think a lot of us just think, well, the next logical step to move into government is, if you're lucky enough to live in a state with a government zoo, that's obviously number one. But I think a lot of people look for ranger positions. That seems to be a really logical next step. You do have to, you know, keep in mind that if you wanted to, you know, for example, if you want to be a fisheries research biologist, you're going to have a degree that's relevant to fisheries research biology. But there's heaps of scope outside of those tertiary qualification jobs that I didn't really even think of. Biosecurity here in Queensland have huge programs, you know, fire ant eradication programs. They've got that crazy yellow jumping ant or whatever it is up north, and different weed species. And so there's heaps of field teams that are out doing that. Department of Environment Science have huge portfolios, from marine strandings through to, you know, koala habitat restoration, koala survey teams. Yeah, I mean, I think it's just important that when you're looking, that you're keeping your mind a bit more open to what maybe is available. It's different for every state. For Queensland, I'd be looking at the agriculture and fisheries side, which incorporates fisheries biosecurity. And then I'd be looking at environment and science for those kind of nature and animal-based jobs in government in Queensland. But, you know, like, we've got some friends down in Victoria who work at Zoos Vic, which is an amazing government-funded zoo, and that opens up. They've got another huge open door for, you know, research through breeding programs and all that sort of stuff. So different state to state. I would say some advice that I think really pays off for people is, if you're willing to move around, there's lots of opportunities throughout the country, and I'm sure for international listeners it's the same, but there's not always opportunities for you in your hometown. And I was so fortunate to be able to stay in roughly southeast Queensland, But I think I probably could have fast-tracked my career if I was prepared to move to Cairns or Corumba or over to Western Australia. They're always looking for fisheries staff over there. So that's something that I would say is well worth thinking about if you want to make the jump. And another thing to think about is to not be too precious about sliding across at level or even taking a slight pay cut or a drop in what you consider to be, you know, your ideal job, because there's so many opportunities once you're in government to build and develop your skills. Yeah, often that can grow really organically and quickly out of taking something at a slightly lower level than you might have wanted to initially.
Yeah, I've been really interested seeing how many of our friends in our Zoom circle have moved into government roles and just the different avenues there are. So it's a cool thought to think that they started off as keepers but might be in a completely different career now, but started off in a zoo industry, obviously. Now, can you discuss what some of the big differences are going from zoo to government work?
I can try. I mean, my time at the zoo was quite a while ago now, and it was a different beast, I guess, back then. Health and safety probably didn't take such a front row seat as it does now in private sector. It always has in government. That was one of the first things I noticed, that they're not going to let you precariously dangle off a ladder with a chainsaw to do the job.
You didn't do that, mate.
No, I didn't. I think the big difference is that when you work in government, you're a part of a machine. You're part of this huge beast that is moving in unison, and it doesn't go well for people who don't acknowledge that. To be good at your job and to do the most, you know, to contribute effectively, you need to stay in your lane and you need to do it well. And I think that's one of the things that I really noticed with the zoo industry. I guess there's more freedom in terms of what you want to get out of the job and what you want to take. In government, I think you have to really get your core work done well before you can start to think about busting out of your lane and turning heads and stuff like that. Obviously, as well, being part of a big machine, there's process that you have to follow. And I know that people do come across and get frustrated with that it's slower, you know, at the zoo and RSPCA. You go sign out petty cash, go down to the hardware store, you buy the stuff you need, and you're into the job 10 minutes later. But you know, with government, there's a process you need to follow, and sometimes that takes a bit more time. I think over time you just learn how to deal with that. You just go, all right, well, that 10 minutes on the process now, and I'll park that until that's cleared and you know, what I need is sitting in front of me, and that might be a day or two away. You just need to get a little bit better at compartmentalizing things, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it sounds like there is a lot of opportunities within government roles, but it might just be also requiring a little bit of patience to just progress at slightly slower rate, but with opportunities that might continue to keep going, keep developing within your career, which doesn't always happen within the zoo world.
No, and I mean, I could be talking out of school because I haven't, you know, worked at a huge zoo. I'd say that probably, you know, the bigger the organisation that you look at, the more it tends to reflect that style where you just can't have people going rogue. You need to have systems in place, and that does take a bit more time. But I do, you know, that's something that I've heard a lot of my friends from the zoo that have come into government say that, geez, it's a shock. It's a shock to just everything has to go through a process.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that might actually time in pretty well, because we were going to have a little chat about some of the listener questions that came in, and what you were saying might be a little bit relevant to this. So the question to start with that we had come through was, what have you found to be the best and the worst things about working within the government jobs?
The best, the opportunities. There's just, you know, I started in fisheries as a field officer, and I think like within a year I was on secondment doing another job as a managing a few people in the team for a short time, and then another secondment as an investigator within fisheries. And this job that I'm in now started as a secondment. There's just opportunities that pop up all over the place if you're prepared to take them. That's, I think, what I find the most exciting, is that you can just continually grow, and it's a really supportive place for building capacity. You know, like every year we sit down, twice a year actually, and we just talk through what do you want to get out of this? Where are you going? What's your career goals? And they do work really hard to try and get you there. So that's I think that's been the most exciting and best thing about it, is that I just feel like everything's at my fingertips. And yeah, the next adventure is not too far away whenever I choose to take it. The worst thing, I think it's, and I don't want to use it, like, it's not the worst thing at all, but it is, it's just a bit of a slower pace. And that's probably not true for all government departments as well. It just being in the particular area that we're in, it's a big area. There's a lot of flow on effects as well. So yeah, you just need to be prepared to run things up the chain, get approvals where you need them, wait for that to come back down.
Now, the next question was a bit more personal, but what would 30-something Chris, we're not going to disclose your age, tell 20-year-old Chris?
20-year-old Chris wouldn't have listened anyway. I don't want to sound cheesy or anything, but I don't think I would have changed much about my pathway so far. I had such a good time at the zoo, and I met my wife and I met my best mates, and
nice.
Good recovery. It was a really fun time, and I think it taught me a lot about what it is to work. It taught me a good work ethic. It taught me a good process for, you know, you're often up against minimal resources and things like that. And it teaches you to be a bit more resourceful and a bit creative about the way you attack problems and stuff. But what I'd say probably if it wasn't me, if it was a 20-year-old who wasn't happy where they were, would be to start to think about where they want to be and don't wait. I think had I wanted to and had I have been a little bit more cluey, I could have made that transition earlier in my life. I started with a guy who was in his early 20s. He worked at BCF, come straight out of BCF. He was prepared to move towns, and he's doing great. And he's doing so good. And I often think, you know, that's a pretty cool start to life, and it's only going to get better. So yeah, I'd probably say to that, have a crack.
Yeah, have a crack. No, I think they're really good things that you've touched on. And I often reflect a lot about wishing that I'd started this earlier, because it, for so long, wasn't sure if it was something that could be a career. And now that I'm in it, I'm like, oh gosh, why on earth didn't I start doing this earlier? But, you know, there's benefits to reflecting, and then there's benefits to just not, and just think of all the places that you've been able to be and the things you've been able to achieve, and focus more, I guess, on what's the future holds and what else is to come to.
Yeah, it is what it is, I guess. But, you know, another thing that I hear so many people say on this podcast when you guys ask about, you know, what does it take to get to where you are and how have you got there, is like putting yourself out there, knuckling down and getting the work done, engaging in it. Like, I mean, when I started that job cutting, I had no idea about that. I didn't know anything about eucalypts. I didn't know anything about koala food. And just sort of got into it and made it my mission to know everything I could about it. And I see the same thing with you guys and with the guests that come on, and they all say the same thing. It doesn't matter if you're not working directly towards the goal that you want, or you're not at the place you want to be. People don't notice, you know, talk, they notice actions. And if you're down there in the trenches getting it done, you're going to get noticed. And
no, I love that. I also love how passionate you still are about eucalyptus leaves, and you'll walk past them and still ID them. So that inner zookeeper/cutter is still in your heart. Still there.
Yeah, I saw those two guys down in Melbourne a little while ago, and I reckon 50% of our conversation was still eucalypt related.
That's
also
great.
When we do our little quotes for social media, yours is just have a crack.
Have a crack. Chris McElligott done.
Mike Jones.
Yeah, could you maybe like put it in front of some misty mountains or something, or some real like ethereal quote.
Maybe some context as well. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Chris. Once again, this is so weird because you're in the room next door and we had to figure out who's getting the mic and the headphones in a little scramble, but it's been really nice to have you on, so thank you very much.
My pleasure. I hope it was hope it answered some questions, and I hope that, you know, if there's anyone out there that wants to jump ship and come to the dark side, that it gives them a couple of pointers that might help.
Yeah, absolutely. And like we said at the start, thank you so much again for all of the effort you put into our podcasting, our editing, all the behind the scenes work. We could not do this without you. So we are incredibly grateful for your time and all the effort you put towards it too.
Thank you. That's very kind. You're being very generous because actually you, Daisy, do most of the editing now. You've self-taught and taken the burden away. So that's very kind of you to say.
No, it's team effort. Well, thank you again, Chris.
Not a problem. Thank you, guys.
First time for everything, Tess, having your husband on a podcast.
Yeah. And as we mentioned before, I think it's kind of cool just to think that there are other avenues. Often we get stuck maybe in our one facility or maybe thinking that our career progression will just be in the zoo world. But he used it as a stepping stone, and the skills that he learned at Lone Pine have helped him to discover his true passions, or maybe even use that as a way of differing roles and that kind of thing. So hope people got a little bit out of the episode. I had fun. And I
yeah.
Hope you did too, Dave.
Yeah, no, definitely. Chris is great to chat to. He's got so much experience. And like you said, it's a great opportunity for people to understand different avenues outside of zoos. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm sure Chris is more than happy if people have any questions as well about that to be reached out to him. And he'll definitely be open to helping out with those things.
Definitely. Yeah, he's very good at government applications. So I don't know.
Yeah. He can help you out. Yes. Well, guys, we hope you enjoyed listening to another episode, and we will be back in your ears next week.